lot of rose scars just to make us.
Serious study after a hard day's work. It just isn't in the cards. It takes exceptional ability. But what you might call the middle class, the professional class, this is part of their business. That's what their business is studying, whether you're a lawyer or what you have. Well, in the Negro people, the one area that was left to them, that the whites did not preempt, was the ministry. So that the Negro minister was the only professional that could actually go to the university, study, do graduate work, and so on. And it's no accident, the Reverend King, for example, is a third-generation minister. With all that that implies, the kind of a home you're brought up to, the kind of early family life you have, the kind of parents, the kind of thinking that goes on, the kind of discussion, the kind of concepts and words that are used. And King, his grandfather was a minister, his father was a minister, he's a minister. He did his work in the regular school, he went to Boston University for graduate work, he came in contact with very progressive ideas up there. As a matter of fact, he was seen around progressive party meetings in the 48 campaign. He's a young man, he's 29 years old. He's a man who has read Hegel and Spinoza and Kant. In my own personal opinion, he hasn't stopped his reading with Hegel. I think he went on to further philosophers. Now, here, therefore, is a man who's giving leadership. I have heard him speak 2 solid hours, without a note, to mass audiences of 2,000 and 3,000 people, working people, Negro people in New York City, for example, speaking in their idiom and at the same time bringing the knowledge. He quoted pages of Kant to them, without a note, just from memory. It was a most impressive performance. The most impressive thing was the way that this man, and there are many more like him, has brought knowledge and practical experience in an integrated whole with an enormous power. This is the meaning of Montgomery, Alabama. It is, I think, worth mentioning just in passing. The strand which went into the Montgomery boycott. There's one minister there who specifically got his ideas from Gandhi, says so, says he studied. There's another one who got it from Thoreau, if you please. And incidentally, it's not generally known that Gandhi got his ideas from Thoreau. So here's a strand of international development, of concepts and ideas, coming to fruition in our country in a very concrete and powerful manner. Now, why do I keep hammering at this concrete? Because to me, it's been the big weakness in the left. Analyze facts. Study them. And wherever the chips fall, let them fall. That's what we're human beings for, not to have our heads in a straitjacket. See? Now, the other thing which I think is of tremendous significance in the Negro people is, of course, the alliance which they're developing very tightly with the union. It was this morning, for example, that the announcement is made of Philip Randolph made the announcement of a committee is being set up at the union to raise $2 million. Last night, for example, a group of us, and it was sort of agreed that if, for example, you push these Dixiecrats out, and then on a fundamental basis, the Democratic Party says, to hell with them, we'll rest upon the farmers and labor. That's the Truman, by the way, the Truman formula. That's how Truman won in 48. He threw away the Dixiecrats, shifted his position on war under the pressure of the Wallace movement, which I think was extremely important, came out with a demagogic program as far as remember the Vincent mission, the famous mission, he was going to send Vincent to Moscow and so on. He was for peace too and so on, and squarely rested upon the farmers and labor and won the election, to everybody's surprise. Now, I think that there's a real objective possibility of this kind of thing happening. If it doesn't happen, the process of it's not happening is the process of creating new conditions. I think this is important. I think it's important to realize that the change takes place on the heels of the previous change. That is, that each action that takes place, or each lack of action, makes the new condition. So that while it might be premature now to discuss the Negro people, and I think it would be completely premature, as an independent force for an independent party, it may not at all be premature 2 years from now, or even a year from now, depending on the result of the Democratic Convention, depending on the result of the presidential election. We just don't know. And I would urge, my own feeling as I look at this, is to have a lot of caution. Not to do nothing, but a lot of caution, because I feel, out of my discussions in New York City, that nobody really feels that they have an answer. I certainly don't. I don't think McManus does. I was listening to the letter, for example. What I get from McManus is, if we, our people, represent the Guardian, it's a grassroots movement. If they had a policy, we would come out editorially for it. But what he says, in effect, is our own people are not divided. I mean, they're not at each other's throats, but nobody quite sees it. It's a very complex thing, very complex problem. One of the most complex problems in politics since the days of the abolitionists, by the way. This is a comparable period. Comparable period. And you don't know which way the cat's going to jump. You don't know which way alliances and shifts will take place. You just don't know. So that therefore, what I get from the New York leadership in these various groupings is that, you know, a Huberman would say, socialism. I won't vote for nobody else but a socialist, would say. All right, it's your privilege. But he doesn't talk for, I don't know, 5%, 10%, 50%, I don't know. But he doesn't talk for 51% of all the progressives, you see. The Communist Party says, into the Democratic Party. Well, they don't talk for all the progressives. Du Bois says, don't vote for nobody. Well, he doesn't talk for all the progressives, you see. Yet, the reason that these people were decent people, intelligent people, come to this conclusion is precisely because the events around them are so confused. And I would myself urge that clarification will take place partly in meetings like these, partly in the development of political action, which is going to take place. I think, by and large, as Jack says, Du Bois is really the minority. That is, very few people really feel that the best thing to say is sit out. You know, as a conscious policy. They may do it because they get disgusted, but not as a conscious policy to propagandize. It's a passive, inactive policy which has very little appeal, and I think fundamentally is wrong. But I think that in the process of the discussion that is taking place, this kind of discussion, the actions which you'll be forced to take in Minnesota, you have to. There's going to be elections. You're going to support Weir, you're not going to support Weir. You're going to support Blank. Now, you know, all kinds of decisions will be under your nose. You have to do them. And incidentally, the best people to do them are the people who are there. I wouldn't quarrel with whatever district leadership in various areas think they should do. And out of that, you begin to formulate a pattern. You see what's going to happen in California. We'll see what happens in Florida. We'll see what happens in all these various things. And incidentally, I like to add one more thing. Find very peculiar ways to express themselves. I think there was one, the real greatness of Lenin, mind you, that he had this smell for what he called moods of the people. You could already see it. I'll give you a very good illustration of America. Here for 10 years, we've been beaten on the head, driven towards war, propagandized for war, and there's no question that the American people have remained anti-war. Yeah, you can't prove it. Until the Eisenhower election in Korea, you couldn't prove that the American people are against war. You couldn't do it. If you went moved around a lot of people, you could say, well, I smell it. That's all I could say. I couldn't prove it anywhere. I couldn't go, you know, there were no meetings, there were no petitions, there were none of the classic manifestations of a protest movement. But by God, it was there. And when Eisenhower says, I'll go to Korea over the radio, it was just a gag, you know, some advertising guy wrote it in. This is really true. It was just stuck into the speech by some loose man who was his advertising, this ghostwriter. He said, you know, well, it didn't hurt, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. Just stuck it in there. It sounded nice. It was what the advertising people, you know, they got dirty words and clean words, you see. Well, yeah, you know, the word that makes you like it and the word that makes you not like it, you see. That was a clean word. You know, peace, sounds nice. He puts it in there and the lid was off. It was blown up. He got stuck. The whole movement developed literally out of that. He comes on the radio, he goes to Korea. When? And incidentally, the UAW made a secret survey which was not released. But in the UAW, the workers' wives went for Eisenhower down the line on that peace issue with their own husbands going down the line for Stevenson because the position international. And you know, in a working class family, for a woman to against her husband on a vote is really a minor revolution. See? Let's not minimize the import. So that this was interesting because you couldn't tell it, you couldn't pinpoint, but it was there. I think in the same way there's very big stirrings going on in this country. I feel it as I go around. On a general decency line, you know, peace, money for schools, money for us, never mind them abroad kind of business, you know. Not an isolationism, but just a sense that, you know, our country comes first kind of thing. Our needs comes first. And there are some significant events in this which took place. At the same time, I find that the Progressive Party as such, that is, you know, has practically disappeared. That is, you know, I go into a town and if it's a 50 group, you end up with four or five people. At the same time, you find another group nobody ever heard of. I live in New York. Right on the spot there, it turned out 50, 60 people in a house meeting. See? And what it is that people who were progressive, now, let's say, suddenly in a church or the Democratic Party or some other organization of some sort, and they're functioning, and they're getting results. And they're very happy and feel very optimistic, you know, and bubbly and whatnot, you see? Now, I think that this kind of sentiment is very widespread. How you tap it is something else again. You know? Find the areas of agreement, they're very big. Look at the factual situation. If you find yourself in disagreement about a perspective 2 or 3 years from now, let it lie. Believe me, nobody knows enough to make it worth a fight. Let it lie. See how it develops. Let the month and the 2 months convene more often, every 6 months. Re-examine the situation. Be prepared to change your own mind, everybody, you know. And be cautious. Get us among the people. That's the basic thing. This, I think, there's no disagreement from anybody. Just let us move amongst the people. You know, Mao Zedong has done a good job on his own. You know, that group over there, they really worked it out, you know. You know, incidentally, we're going to put a book out by Christmas, which is going to be a loot. I can't tell you what it is, it's a secret. But join Liberty and you'll get it. But what they've done over there over a 20-year period is just fantastic. And Mao Zedong had one saying, which is, I think, perhaps basic for what they've done. He said, we progressives are only a few in a huge country. Don't forget, you're talking about a country of 500 million people. You think America's big?
600 million.
You know, you think this country's big. You think this country's got different regional problems. You should be in the, you know, they got Mohammedans, they got confusions. They range from the coldest, damn near Arctic conditions to the hottest subtropical conditions. Fantastic country, which I have been in, by the way, and it just staggers you. And the amount of people just amaze you. You know, there's so many of them. And he said, we're just few. We're only about, you know, a couple hundred thousand. So here we are. But that's a few over there. It's not, you know, in India and China, when you have a little meeting like this, you get 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 people. That's a small meeting. I mean, that's literally, I'm serious. That's a pickup meeting, you know? Not too big organization, not too much advertising. Then when they get really serious, like Krishna and Mulgana, they had 3 million in Calcutta. 3 million! The biggest meeting in the whole history of the human race. And they don't fool. Right? Now, but Mao Zedong, as I said, had this saying. He said, we're only a few. He said, and we're amongst the people. And he said, we are strength is from the people. He said, we should think of ourselves as the fish in the sea. And I keep telling people all the time, it's a wonderful phrase, the fish in the sea. It both gives you a place to move and it supports you. And that's what these progressives are. And I think that's what we are. We are the fish in the sea of America. But we can do an enormous amount of good and we can do a lot of harm by just, you know, dissipating our strength. So to conclude, I got to run. Please sign up for Liberty, but consciously, I'm serious about it. Don't leave today without signing. If you can't afford it, okay, we're friends. But if you can't afford it, you're not being nice. So please sign up. No? Two, get these. Buy a few. They're 2 bits apiece, 5, 4, 5, 6. Take them back to your organization. Okay, thank you very, very much.
So the place yesterday afternoon, we were scoring a little bit on the fun report, and all of a sudden we were going to the
obvious that in the farm problem, one of the major issues that is facing the farmer is peace. However, there's a great variation in the problems of the farmer, which is reflected in the report of which I don't know how many of you have seen. The Grain Terminal Association made a survey in 5 states, and they have selected in Minnesota's 6 counties that have been averaged, and they show the income for the farmer. And these incomes vary of about two $2,300, that is total net income, in Wisconsin to an average of $6,900 for Montana. But we must keep in mind that this is the capital or the money available for the whole family, and that includes the income investment. If we take 5% on the investment, like Jackson County in southern Minnesota, the average farm family, the operator and his family, received $420 minus for his labor for the year 1954. And so the family, that is the hourly pay, as reflected in the various states, the return on the investment at 5%, Wisconsin has 14 cents an hour. In Minnesota, it's 7 cents. In South Dakota, it is 4 cents. In North Dakota, 10 cents. In Montana, 54 cents an hour. There's a real depression afoot in the Midwest as far as the farmers are concerned. And that's reflected in the average of 150,000 farmers having left the farm nationally for the last 4 years. And this is reflected in for instance, in the Mesabi Range, in a mine, 70% of the workers in this mine in the Mesabi Range are ex-North Dakota farmers. I mean, it's really amazing. And so we find that in the area surrounding the Twin Cities and any concentrated population area, it ranges from 50% to 75% of the farmers are engaged in some work outside their farm operations in order to maintain themselves and their families. And we must recognize that labor is faced with a real problem. With the unemployment rising, as a matter of fact, in Minneapolis alone, there has been an average of 13,700 unemployed for the year 55. That's the average for the whole year. And so labor better consider the fact that if they will have 1 million farmers knocking on the doors at factory gates for jobs, it's going to create a serious situation, which is already serious with the vast unemployment that is occurring in the centers of manufacture like Detroit, the auto centers of Detroit, Flint, and Toledo, and all those other places. And what has to be developed is a program for family farmers so they can stay on the land. And this can only be achieved through for the present, of course, we must recognize and not kid ourselves that this is going to be a solution to our whole farm program or problem, but it certainly has to be instituted for the present in order to maintain a large number of people in a position where they can exist and live without being destroyed. And that means that we have to work for a full parity, and this on the basis of production payments, real conservation payments, federal credits, a housing program that will reach into the rural areas, federal aid for roads, hospitals, schools, health, improved social security for the aged farmers and the ones who are on the verge of retiring. And there is actually a farm revolt, which is expressed quite definitely in the past primaries in this state, because certainly the farmers expressed their opposition or their disgust with the program that advanced by the administration, and also by the main Democratic Party, and the fact that Key Farmer received such an overwhelming vote in Minnesota, and mainly in the rural areas, was because he spoke out for a real immediate farm program. And this is further expressed in the breakaway of the League from a 40-year tradition of supporting and filing their candidates in the Republican column. And this is a renewed constitutional league in which they are filing their candidates in the Democratic column. And we must recognize that this is an unprecedented action on the part of an old established political organization, independent political organization. And this farm revolt is also expressed in the reversal of the administration on the support price situation, where they were forced to revise the price support of wheat from $2 up to $2 from $1.81, and they raised the corn parity up from 75 to 82.5%, and the dairy products from 75 to 80. And then we must recognize that there's a new important. I can see only possible way is to work where the people are, because we certainly aren't going to get any place by sitting around talking to ourselves. And that's actually been primarily the situation that's prevailed in the state for a long time, because we have a definite tradition in the state of a liberal tradition or a progressive tradition, and it goes way back to maybe in the 1880s when the populist movement first began. But and there's a lot of descendants of the first operators in these movements. I know in my own county, for instance, there is a great number of people who were active in the populist movement, the Farmers Alliance, back in the 80s and 1900, and then they had quite a number of socialist locals in from 1907 to 1915, and then the Nonpartisan League came in, and these are reservoirs of potential political movements that we must figure out a way where we can help them along and get the basis for real political action. There's so few people in the metropolitan areas who understand the real plight of the farmers that it's very inadequate to report on a basis of a short time like this. But if there's anyone who in this room who are interested to receive this volume that was put out by the farmers, that is the Grain Terminal Association, it's available if you communicate with the Farmers Union headquarters at the Grain Terminal Association.
After all reports are in, I'd like to call on Fred Potashny now to report for 5 minutes on the dire condition of our financial committee.
Green. To face forthrightly the usual problem, one which unfortunately I've become somewhat identified with, somewhat against my better judgment, in the past couple of years. However, it's one of the things that practical, although sometimes impractical, politicians that we are, we're practical enough to know that you can't even do a minimum job without having a minimum kind of campaign fund. Perhaps one of the difficulties which we have found ourselves in the last 2 or 3 years is the fact that we have been existing in something like a self-imposed isolation from the stream in which the fish are swimming. And that it's interesting to see that many expressions have already been made here to the effect that there is a new perspective in the eyes of the progressive forces, and that for a change, perhaps, and I think a very important change, We are preparing in whatever way that we each of us finds the most effective to launch ourselves into the stream and to not only teach to other people that little bit which we know, but also that we're preparing to learn from them a lot that they know, which we perhaps have missed. And in order to be this effective, obviously, you know what I'm going to ask you for, but obviously we do need some fun with which to start.
Sir, the Negro people are engaged in a great surging movement for full citizenship rights, sparked by the NAACP, supported by such large labor organizations as the United Automobile Workers. School desegregation, authoring Lucy's magnificent fight for admittance into Alabama University, the Montgomery bus boycott, the mass indignation expressed at the murder of Emmett Till, are points of high drama in a fight for freedom that permeates the air. Politicians are being forced to take their stand on civil rights legislation. McCarthyism no longer holds the nation in thrall. McCarthy, the man, is still around, but McCarthyism, that state of mental terror in which if a man while discussing art would say, I have a Picasso, would feel immediately impelled to say, I am not a communist, and I've heard him do it. This point is happily past. The dethroning of McCarthy took many and diverse forms.
About a report on just women, asking a woman to give a report on just women. We always say the name man embraces women. So I suppose women embrace men too. And after all, when we look at the world situation, we have to take in our whole human family. As I thought about this report, I thought, well, don't let your report get out of hand. The time here is so precious, and if you start talking, there are some things that a woman likes to talk into next week about. And these themes are those. If you can just talk, just like Matsami said this morning, he said he could talk for hours. So I too have prepared a written report. And I start in by saying I'm glad to be invited to be here today in company with so many brave souls who have survived the fantastic insanities of the McCarthy Inquisition, the barbarities of the evil designs of the McCarran-Smith Acts, and have come here with whole skins and a wholesome respect for your own personal integrity in the matter of preserving the sacred right of opinion. It has not been easy. Easier it would have been to join that craven throng calling for the crucifixion of progressive thought and action. It has taken the fortitude of such men as Elmer Benson and the fighting spirit of Fred Stover to see us through. And so let us felicitate each other. Let us testify to the saving faith in the power of love to solve human problems. And the strength of this faith shall be as the leaven that leaveneth the whole lump. Meanwhile, mourn not the dead, but rather mourn that apathetic throng, the cowed and meek, who see the world's great anguish and its wrong and dare not speak. These are the ones needing our sympathy today, and I'm sad to say that they are legion. As I look at the myriad of world conflicts today, I try to evaluate the size and scope of the contributing factors. To me, these prime factors always seem motivated by greed for more power, for more wealth and more power. The marvelous natural resources of the USA are not enough. There's gold and tungsten in Korea, rubber and diamonds in Africa, oil in Arabia and Iran, and boundless wealth in other areas, all being periodically conditioned by John Foster Dulles into recognizing our sacred right of enlightened self-interest, and nobly protected by our power of massive retaliation. Strange to say, these Arab impeachments have not been wholly accepted by the world as a whole. And Mr. Dulles in his brilliant and expensive role of globetrotter, may find himself sitting one day all dressed up with nowhere to go. One California lady even had the temerity to suggest to President Eisenhower, don't drop bombs, drop Dulles. The London Daily Mirror has taken vigorous pot shots at John Foster Dulles. I was just amazed to see it. Calling him old funeral face and doleful Dulles. Well, now here is the editorial. It says he is the original crabapple. Doleful, doleful Dulles. Why does Dulles always act like a big sourpuss on world affairs? Whenever things are looking hopeful, he peers at the good news and sees something fishy. The man is a persevering pessimist. The Mirror says no one pretends that Russia does anything out of brotherly love, but that the Soviet decision to demobilize 1 to 200,000 men is an occasion for cheering. Mr. Dulles does not cheer at all. He merely observes in his grumbling, grumpy way that he would rather have Russian soldiers standing around doing guard duty than in factories making atomic bombs. Doleful Dulles. Even if Russia outlawed the Communist Party, destroyed its atom bomb plants, held free elections, and restored the czars, John Foster Dulles would still say there was a catch in it. Then they conclude he is the original crabapple. Well, so much for Dulles. Anyway, I'm very sorry. Enjoy some of those fruits of a free economy himself. He's just hoping that he will. This planned suffering has been previously extended to the farmers as a whole in a 23% loss in the farm prices. And the small farmers have been told in no uncertain terms to move to town. Ezra Benson was in St. Paul at the auditorium not so long ago. I didn't hear him. I happen to have my nose to the grindstone. I'm working every day. And so I just had to go by reports. But I was talking to one of the men that had been there, and he said that after the speech there was some questioning. And there was a farmer that asked him about how it would be for me if I should move to town. I've always been a farmer. I don't know how to do anything else but farm. Of course, maybe I could shovel something. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? What, is that a wonderful picture? Yes. Maybe he had a nice home. Maybe he had, maybe he knew what he was going to eat tomorrow, where he was. You know, when it just burns me up when I hear about that the little farmer is supposed to go to town and go into industry. My nephew in Red Wing has a secondhand store, and it's all full of junk like every other secondhand store. And people keep coming in, and our town is a factory town, and there are lots of people, you know, that don't have too much money, and they see that kind so much. Well, they'll maybe want something, and they'll ask to put it aside. They'll pay 25 cents down, or they'll pay 50 cents down, and maybe they'll never come for it at all because the rest of it hasn't been forthcoming. Well, I said to this friend, I was telling him about my nephew and his business, and I said, well, they call the little farm a subsistence farm. What about those subsistence farms in the, what about those subsistence jobs in the town? What about them? And my nephew says, why? He says, and Susie, he says, they don't know what they're going to eat tomorrow. He says, they just live from hand to mouth. Well, bless me. I'd rather be out on a little farm with a couple of hens and maybe a cow in the barn. I'd much rather live there and know just about what my resources were than go to town and get a shovel and maybe not even have a job to shovel. I'd much rather do that. I said, just think of that. I said, now that the farmers cannot pay on their mortgages. They come in and ask for extensions of their mortgages, and then up goes the interest rates. Couldn't you get mad about that? I don't usually get mad, but I can get mad about that. I think that's terrible. To complete the picture, Hal Stassen is out, blasting labor racketeering in an effort to show the menace of labor unions. Absolutely. He isn't so much interested in a few individual labor racketeers as to show, give the whole picture of racketeering on the part of the whole labor movement. Sure, if you can only do that, you know, the great stuff, he can do most anything. Well, so I say, the way it looks to me, if the money can eliminate the independent vote of the small farmer and the vote of the organized labor, then the coast is clear for a new heyday era for organized monopoly. Yes, because that's really the only thing that they have to fear is the independent vote. And if they can destroy that, then they have free sailing. All of which calls to mind the situation in the 20s and the 30s. And the question asked movie star Hayes, how the growing revolt could be stayed. And he answered, give drinks to the men and sex slush to the women. That was his solution. We got both the drinks and the sex slush with a vengeance, and later another world war. And to think of that is too terrible. It's too terrible to think about. And another world war conflagration is not yet out of the picture. Why, in my home paper, that was Friday night's paper, there's a big headline. Said H-bomb test reveals U.S. can destroy any city in the world. How great we are. Terror. I think we should stop boasting about how many people we can kill and how much we can destroy. Let us take a leaf out of the book of Nehru, of India, and go about seeing what he can straighten out, what he can smooth over, what goodwill he can find. You know what Wendell Willkie said when he had been around the world? He came back and he said, the United States has an enormous reservoir of goodwill in the world. That was true then. It is not true now. There's a reason. Much that I read in The Woman Citizen, but I'll never forget this. It just asked a little question. If the women of the world should organize against war, would not that be enough? Would not that be enough? And who have a more legitimate right to organize the world over than the women, the mothers, and the wives and the sisters of the world? Who have a more legitimate right? They oppose, the women of the world are organizing against war. The women of France and England and Scandinavia, the Low Countries, Germany and the Soviet Union, and we have good women in our own country. Vienna Hendrickson was just telling me about her trip to Washington. It just thrilled me at noon to hear about it. As a representative of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Women are beginning to think that they own their own souls and that they have a right to organize against the sins of the world, the evils of the world, in the interest of their own dear ones. These women oppose all armaments. They want peaceful homes, peaceful trade, peaceful travel, peaceful culture, a religion of peace. They know what war is. They know the unspeakable story. Peace demands a cooperative society, not a competitive one. We must build in the nation and the world as we build in our homes, with loving service and thought of the needs of others, in all our relationships in society, in our schools and churches. We must foster the spirit of a cooperative consideration of the needs and welfare of others, in wholehearted support of Henry Drummond's tenet that love is the greatest power in the world. Even a dog knows it. Why, you just take any dog, and you love him, and before you know it, he'll grab your tail. Yes, even an animal knows that love is the greatest thing in the world. You know, I was interested I stayed overnight with the Hawkinses, and I think it was this morning, Mrs. Hawkinses, that I looked in the newspaper there. I saw the report by Carl Rowan. He'd been to Africa, and the heading was, "Force is not the answer in Kenya." Force is not the answer in Kenya. Will you tell me where force is the answer? Nowhere. Why use it? I think perhaps the Progressive Party movement in Minnesota is at the point now where it might be better to call ourselves the Independent Voters Committee. I think perhaps that would be better because there is a lot of independent thinking in other groups. There's a lot of it. And I think it might be a very good thing. But we must maintain an organization, and we must maintain a bureau and an active organization. You know, I remember an old friend talking about the evils of the world, and he paraphrased a portion of the Bible when he said, "The wicked fleeth when no man pursueth." And he added in his own words, "But he makes better time when there's somebody after him."
Twice as much more readers to The Guardian can raise the level of understanding in your community. It is up to us to see The Guardian is read everywhere. And I've put down a few facts in regard to the Free Press of America here. There are 1,780 daily newspapers in the U.S. 90% of these papers have no competition in their areas of circulation. Thus, there is a virtual monopoly of news and readership. The Minneapolis Star controls the whole readership of Minneapolis. That's pretty well known. 14 newspapers control 25% of total circulation, while less than 50 owners control nearly one-half of all Sunday circulation. And this is from the report of the Commission on Freedom of the Press, President Robert Hutchins from the University of Chicago. Actually, the monopoly is even greater because even the independent newspapers serve their readers the same columnists and United Press, Associated Press dispatches. Newspapers are dependent on the giant corporations for advertising, tobacco, auto, electrical equipment, department stores, and so forth. In Minnesota, there is no competition, even the most nominal, in any city in this state. All national and world news comes to the readers through the AP and the AP syndicated columnists, Winslow, Dorothy Thompson, Reisel, David Lawrence, and Lippmann. Rural and small town weeklies are less independent. All receive and print the canned copy, lasts, and other features from the National Association of Manufacturers. In all this, the aim of the monopoly press is to confuse and misinform the people. Yet most people do not understand this. The Guardian can organize liberal sentiment in the 5th District to defeat Congressman Judd by bringing forward the issue. This must be carefully worked out. Expanding the circulation of The Guardian does not only mean extension of our ideas and influence and ability to combat the lies of the big press. It also means regular contact with people and regular activity among people. To promote the paper here through this state, to promote the paper, we should see that it is sold more consistently to the labor movement at the Minneapolis Central Labor Union halls and in the communities. We should, of course, we also need more clubs. And I'm going to, if you have time, Mr. Chairman, have Patsy a couple words after I finish. In regard to these clubs, we want to call for volunteers to be. And in the rural areas, we should cover farmers' union picnics this summer in rural areas. And I think there we could get copies and distribute them.
Reunification on the American left. Malvina Reynolds, who is the Guardian
Francisco sends regards from the Guardian Club in San Francisco, which I personally had the privilege of attending a meeting of, and at which, incidentally, they divided.
Well,
tell them about your wild adventures fishing.
Which wild adventures? I mean, the fact that that motor, Martin 66, which I call
it my
Martin 66 anyway. I have an outboard motor I've used for the last 5 years, which is really my father's, but he never uses it. Alan Bennett and I got all the way across the lake to what's called Four Mile Bar, and I think it's called Four Mile Bar because it's 40 miles from anywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got there, and we started back, and we threw a rod in the motor. Of course, we didn't know we threw a rod. All we knew was that the motor locked and locked solid with a sudden bang, and we started to try to take it apart there in the middle of the lake. Alan was worried at the same time that Florence was running out of formula and had no canned milk in order to make formula, so we were both going nuts trying to get the motor started, and we finally discovered that we just couldn't do it. It was frozen solid. So we rowed. And we rowed, and we rowed, and we rowed. We got back, and I tied up the minnow bucket. First, when I got back, I was tied up the minnow bucket.
That's the new one I bought.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I got to tell them about that story. First of all, the motor. We take the motor, and we take it all apart. We discover we threw a rod in a brand new, not brand new, but a nice motor that I had. Now it turns out to be a pile of junk. You know, before we started, remember I sent you to the store, and I asked you to buy, I wanted to go to the store, and then you had to go and get something, so you said you'd go to the hardware store, and I said, get a minnow bucket. So Rachel comes back with a minnow bucket that's really a minnow bucket. I mean, not just a plain, ordinary bucket for minnows, but this is it. It's a real McCoy, see? It isn't even round, it's oblong. This thing did everything but shine your shoes. So last year I bought a minnow bucket.
It was a floating minnow.
Floating minnow bucket, oblong, everything. Last year I bought a minnow bucket and I lost. The trip before that last year that went on with Alan, he lost a minnow bucket. Previous to that, Alan had lost a minnow bucket.
They never catch fish though.
But we lose lots of minnow buckets. So Alan and I got a phobia. We're not going to lose minnow buckets. So even with the motor, set as it is, I tied that minnow bucket up and we had minnows in it, threw it over. We come back down. We take a look at the minnow bucket. The floating minnow bucket isn't floating. I reach down, and there at the end of the cord is the outside of the minnow bucket, but the inside part that floats, independent of it, is gone. And I almost tore my hair out. It couldn't be. Not another minnow bucket.
We figured if it wasn't the floating kind, it would have sunk to the bottom where it's about 2 feet deep. But here we imagined it floating all over the lake.
Well, it was more than 2 feet, but it was about 4 feet anyway.
Oh, down there? It
wasn't too deep. Anyway, all the young kids in the place put on their bathing suits and they all went diving and they swore they couldn't find it. So all week that we were there until Friday, it was Friday, wasn't it? Yeah, Friday, we cursed and
we were leaving Saturday.
We cursed and swore and aggravated ourselves because we didn't have a minnow bucket and I'd be damned if I would have put out 5 cents for another one. And finally, Friday, in the middle of the afternoon, Alan and Florence were fishing. Rachel and I were taking care of the kids. And I told one of the Bennett kids were sleeping. And we put on the bathing suits and all the kids. And I told Rachel that she should take them all swimming, and I'd stay with the ones that were swimming.
Sleeping.
But it was so hot that I thought I'd take a dive off the dock before she came. She left with the other kids because then I'd have to go up to the cabin. And I dove off the dock and I swam around a while and I started to swim back and I said, you know, I think I'll look for the minnow bucket. And I swam under the dock right at the point. Well, Rachel all along had said it was going to be under the dock. And everybody...
This was a dock. The lakes are so high here because it's so much rain and this dock has been built up. Was the third time when we were leaving, we were building it again. And so you really couldn't see between the boards under the dock like you might have.
And all the time we told the kids to keep looking under there, and they kept telling us that's where they were looking. Sure enough, I dove under, came up under the dock, and there was my minnow bucket, about 2 feet from where it had been tied, only underneath the dock where no one could see it.
It wasn't
stuck at all. It was just there, floating underneath the dock. So that problem got solved. You know, all in all, we had a lot of fun on that vacation.
One night they returned at 2 a.m. after saying they told us to wait till 11. If they didn't get back, they'd be catching fish and we should go to bed. So we almost went to bed at 11, for us and I had some coffee and talked for quite a while. But we finally decided, well, it was enough. They're catching fish and went to our cabins and started getting ready for bed in Kanawha, saying, we don't fish, we have adventures. It turns out since 11 o'clock they had been lost.
Oh, yeah.
On the lake. It was Osakis.
That was the day I was captain.
Osakis is a big lake, and, you know, what a real dark night. And it's not as big as Mille Lacs. You can see the shores, but everyone turns off the lights, and there aren't any landmarks that you can see unless you just hug the shore. If you hug the shore of Lake Osakis, it'll take you a few days. So they estimated the direction well and finally found somebody who told them where to go, and they got back home.
We hit the shore. We aimed for, there were two lights on the shore of the lake. We were across the bay in 18-mile, at the 18-mile bar, which is called 18-mile bar because it's 73 miles away. And there was a dark night.
There's no 18-mile bar. It's 2 miles and 3 miles.
No, it's four and three and four. Anyway.
It's a 2 mile. I heard somebody said
that's a 2 mile cove or something. Anyway, it's the craziest lake. It's got thousands of miles of shoreline. I mean, the lake looks small wherever you are, but it just keeps going and going and going all over the place.
They have weeds in that lake I'd never seen before. They call them pipe weeds, and they were like long, well, they're like reeds, and they would stick straight up, and you could tie them to your boat, and your boat would stay there. You couldn't pull them up.
You couldn't see them at night either.
That's where the sunfish were, and so when you would go sunfishing, you spent most of your time getting untangled from the reef. Ken and Alan caught a lot of good-sized sunfish. In fact, this is the lake where the prize-winning sunfish come from.
Yeah, a couple of guys in the cabin next to us that fished for sunfish consistently instead of trying for big ones like we did came up with a couple of two-pound sunnies, and if you recall when you used to fish for sunnies, that's a big sunfish. Just imagine a sunfish the size of a full dinner plate. I mean, as big around as a good-sized dinner plate. They're really huge. And when we finally found, the second day we were there, we found a sunny hole in among the weeds. We pulled up about, just under 50 sunnies in about an hour and a half, all of which were very, very nice size, much better size than anything I think you've ever seen or I've ever seen in all the years I've been fishing anyplace else. But good as the sunnies were, you know, just because the sunnies are so easy to catch and they're there, naturally we fish for everything else besides sunnies.
Not to change the subject, but I'd like to tell them about Willie.
Tell them about Willie.
Willie Schwartz.
You mean our steer we bought?
Is the farmer from whom we bought our steer. He is one of a handful of Jewish dirt farmers in Minnesota. He and his wife got out of Germany in 1938-39. And can't say goodnight to David right now. You can hear it in the background.
Good night, Dick.
Good night to Robin and Devin Bernie.
Good night, Robin, Devin, Bernie. I hope you have good dreams tonight.
Good night, David.
Good night.
Did you hang up your towels and get your clothes out of the bed? Good. Mama's seen you, don't ask her. Anyway, so Ken went out and picked out the steer. I'm pretty sentimental to do that and eat it too. And I went out later to meet Willie. One of the days we were farm hunting.
Can I tell him about the dung?
Well, wait a minute. No,
I have to tell him about the dung.
So we went out and met Willie, and here's Willie with his baler. He got a brand new baler, and he was playing with it like a toy, having a big time with it, complaining that they were charging him more than the other people for baling the hay. And so he went out and bought himself a $1,500 baler. He works in South St. Paul and farms on the side. I don't know how good a farmer on the side is, but he took us over his land.
he's got a Shetland pony and a big horse. Both are black and white and seem to have exactly the same coloring. They're very strange together. And then he had only a few steer then. He says he needs 30 to keep the grass down. And way back there was a woods. And he says, see that woods? He says, I keep that for sentimental reasons. He says, there's a lake there, so I don't have to carry water for the steer. And someday, he says, maybe I can make it a little deeper. And he smiled. And his reasons for having the farm, he said that his in-laws were very angry at him for taking his wife on the farm. His in-laws are professors in California. And his wife is an artist, and one of his children is also an artist, and they don't think that he should be a farmer or take her on the farm. But he looks around and he says, but I like it here. He says, I come home from work, and this is really life. He says, well, all around you, you really see things living, and this is real, and I like it. And he's a real beautiful guy. Well, anyway, he raises
pigs. He's also a little bit of a nut. Rachel didn't.
Well, Kenny thinks that everybody who's any is interesting is a nut.
No, he's this guy for other reasons.
But you really do think everybody's interesting is a nut.
No, not everybody.
So he has some pigs. So we go over to see his pigs. And he comes over and you know how farm Debbie knows how farmers call pigs pig. He comes over and he says, hey, Kazara! You don't understand that ass play what the transplant is. It was, you know, real Jewish pigs. It's the funniest thing I ever heard.
These were kosher pigs.
Then he explains, he shows us how the beans are planted, one row this way and one row that way, like contour farming. And he says, look at the way these beans are planted. He says, you don't see Goyim planting beans like that. He says, these Goyim don't know how to farm. Now this, to me, was the most fantastic statement I've ever heard because, I mean, this is everybody but him. He doesn't know how to farm.